You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the RSA. I'm Matthew Taylor, the Chief Executive. I should warn you, any of you who've popped into this event at lunchtime from work, when you've listened to the speakers, you may decide not to go back to work this afternoon and instead to spend the afternoon visiting art galleries, talking to people, or simply meditating. But it's my great pleasure to welcome today's speakers, Robert and Edward Skidelsky. Robert is a life peer, an emeritus professor of political economy at the University of Warwick, an award-winning biographer, essayist, and columnist. He's widely regarded as one of our most distinguished economic thinkers. Edward is a lecturer in philosophy at Exeter University. His research interests cover moral and political philosophy. He's written on a wide range of subjects, including the intellectual roots of neoconservatism and the ethics of capitalism. And he contributes regularly to New Statesman and Prospect. Father and son join us today to discuss their new co-authored book, How Much is Enough? A provocative and timely call for a moral approach to economics, drawing on philosophers, political theorists, writers, and economists from Aristotle to Marx to Keynes. In the book, Robert and Edward tackle some of the really big issues around the value of money, work, and the good life. What really matters in our lives, and how do we attain it? Important questions for uncertain times, and we're delighted you've been able to join us today to explore those issues with us. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Robert and Edward Skidelsky.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Ed, I thought maybe we could start by saying a bit about how we came to write this book together. I've been working for a long time on Keynes, and I thought I'd finished with him in a way, but for various reasons he seemed to be nagging at me. And one of the things I was struck by was that all his economic work was set in a moral framework. I mean, he was a moralist. He came from that generation of economists who believed that you should have ends as well as means. And so he always regarded money as a means to something, rather than as an end in itself. He always asked the question, what is money for? So that kept me interested in him. And then I think somehow you were approaching the same question from a different angle.
Yeah, I mean, my route into this really comes from reading ancient philosophy, actually, so something very far removed from the current world. I teach moral philosophy at Exeter, and 3 years ago I did a course in Aristotle with my students, and I was very struck by Aristotle's remarks on the meaning of money and wealth, and how they connected up with things that Keynes said. So I think that's how we converged on this topic.
Yeah, I think Aristotle was obviously writing about a static society, and Keynes was writing about a dynamic, a democratic, an industrial society, and so he was more of a utopian in his views. He thought this was something that was going to happen. The good life was going to happen in the future, so to speak. But there was enough convergence that we really thought we had a book there.
Yeah, and Robert hit upon a brilliant title: How Much Is Enough? I think we thought of the title before we actually thought of the book.
And then we went away and wrote it. I mean, we talked about it a lot, and then we decided we had to have a period when we just went away and wrote the book together. And so we went to the south of France, to a little village called Cône-Minervois in Languedoc, and we spent 2 months there, and that really broke the back of it, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we didn't quite finish it, but we got over the hump. What specifically in Keynes really got you interested in this subject? And what was the trigger?
Well, the trigger was this. In 1930, Keynes wrote a little essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. And it was in the depth of the Depression. But he said, I want to take wing into the future. What will life be like in 100 years' time? Given the fact that technology is always progressing and people are getting wealthier, what sort of lives will they lead? And so he made a couple of pretty remarkable predictions. He said, if things go on more or less as they are now, in about 100 years' time, that is coming close to where we are today, in our grandchildren's time, we would be four or five times as rich as we were then in 1930. And because that amount of production would be obtainable at a very small fraction of the effort which was then being employed in production, because, you know, there'd be automation and things, he thought that we wouldn't have to work more than 15 hours a day.
Okay. We can
15 hours a week. 15 hours a day is another question. 15 hours a week.
Okay, we can represent this. Here we go. So blue represents GDP per capita. Red represents hours of work.
So by you know, somewhere around here, we would be 20 or below. I mean, but we'd be coming down.
Under 20.
Under 20. These are rough. These are rough things. So that was the prediction. Now what happened?
Okay. So, well, here's growth.
Here's growth. That prediction was pretty accurate.
So this is blue is Keynes's forecast, red is what's actually
happened.
You've
actually grown a bit faster.
Yeah. But what about
the hours of work? You see, that was his forecast, and then the red line is the hours of work. Now the thing is, hours of work have come down, but they've basically remained stuck at about 40. In fact, they've gone up slightly in the last 5 or 10 years. So on average, we still work a 40-hour week. And I emphasize on average because there are lots of little twists in that. For example, the Americans work much harder, longer hours than we do, as you'd expect Americans to. The Dutch work less hard. They're closer to 30. We're sort of nearer the Americans.
I mean, this... Yeah. And it's quite striking that Keynes was so nearly right about growth.
Yeah.
I mean, he got that pretty much spot on, but so wrong about working hours.
Yes. I would just say one more thing about working hours, which is that the rich often work the hardest of all. I don't think they work harder than other people, but the rich certainly work hard. So we talk a lot about the greedy rich now, but very few people talk about the idle rich. And so that's contrary to what people expected, isn't it? Rich people, the old aristocrats, they weren't expected to work at all.
Yeah, and that, I mean, and in the sense, I mean, Keynes's prophecy was it was quite standard among economists at the time. They expected that, you know, as people became more productive, so they'd naturally work less. As they were able to produce everything they needed in shorter and shorter hours, they'd do so. So what went wrong? I mean, why didn't it work out as Keynes thought? How can we explain this?
Well, I think he made a number of errors in his. There were a number of errors in his thinking. First of all, he thought that wants were finite, and that once we'd reached a certain level in which all our needs were satisfied, we would ease off. We would sort of trade work for more leisure. That seemed to him to be the rational thing to do. But in fact, what happened was, it turns out, we now realize that wants are pretty insatiable. And the reason they're insatiable is because they're relative. We're always comparing our fortune to others and in some way finding it wanting. I mean, a good example of that is the conspicuous consumption, especially of the new rich. They simply want others to know how rich they are. And then others get envious of how rich they are, and they want to be richer still and have even more conspicuous consumption. Secondly, I think, our civilization puts us under tremendous pressure to consume. It's a competitive consumption drive. And first of all, it is a very competitive civilization. And secondly, there is this constant advertising pressure to find your souls in your shopping. We'll come back to that in a minute. I think there's a third factor as well, And that is that we're not, or most of us, aren't quite as rich or wealthy or well off as the average figures suggest. There's a crucial distinction, which I think one has to grasp, between the average or mean and the median incomes. The average incomes in the UK, average income is £27,000 a year per disposable income per household. But the median is only 21,000. The official poverty line is 60% of the 21,000, 60% of the median income. That's defined as the poverty line, which is 13,000 a year. And there are 13 million people in this country below that poverty line. So although average income is maybe enough, there are a hell of a lot of people who haven't got the average income, and they're still trying to get an income that would give them a good life. And then there was also, I think, a more philosophical explanation of Keynes's mistake, if you like. As we said before, he was grounded in a philosophical tradition in which you tended to think about wealth as a means to something else rather than an end itself. He was well educated in a way economists aren't today, and particularly in the Greeks and Aristotle. Yeah. He knew that very well.
And this is where it links in with the things I'm interested in. In his book, The Politics, Aristotle talks quite a lot about money and wealth, and he makes a very interesting distinction between two kinds of money-making. One he calls a natural kind, and then another he calls an unnatural kind. And the natural kind of money-making is when you make just enough to sustain a good way of life. So for Aristotle, this would have meant the life of an Athenian country gentleman with a few acres, some vineyards, some olive groves, some slaves to work it. He was living in a slave society.
They didn't have a good life.
No, they didn't have a good life. It was frankly inegalitarian. And once you'd got enough of this, you stopped accumulating. That was the sort of the rational thing to do. But then there's also, he says, an unnatural kind of money-making where you just go on wanting more and more and more. Regardless of what you actually need, you become insatiable. And for Aristotle, it was money that was really the serpent in the garden here. I mean, money has this odd property that you just want more and more of it. And this isn't true of concrete goods. To go on collecting more and more, I don't know, beds, say, would just be plain irrational. It'd be crazy. You only need so many beds. But once you start calculating your wealth in terms of money rather than concrete goods, there is this tendency to just want more and more and more of it. And he doesn't say why. He just observes it. He quotes the great Athenian lawgiver, Solon. No bounds to riches have been fixed for man. So Aristotle notes this as a fact of human psychology, but he deplores it. He thinks it's a mark of our irrationality. He doesn't just treat it as a sort of neutral fact of human nature in the way that modern economists do. So wealth has a natural limit, which is what we need to lead a good life, but there's something in human nature that tends always to surpass these limits, to want more and more. And these ideas were hugely influential throughout the Middle Ages and well into the modern era. The medieval scholastic philosophers drew on Aristotle his idea of this insatiable desire for more. They called it avaritia, or avarice. And the interesting thing is we can even find parallels to this way of thinking in countries totally alien from the West, in India and China. Obviously, the ideas of what constituted a good life differed hugely, but all these cultures had some notion of a good life, a life that's objectively desirable in and of itself. And they all thought of money as a means to the end of a good life.
Well, of course, some economists have tried to revive this idea of money simply as a means to something else. But when you ask them, well, what is that something else? They say happiness. Yeah. And happiness studies are big now. They're big in politics, big in the United Nations. But we really thought that that was not the right answer, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I suppose, you know, the economist's way of recapturing the old idea of wealth as a means to an end. You know, in a way they can make sense of. And the idea is now that you know, enough means enough to make us happy. And you know, if you define enough in that way, it does look as if we in the West have enough, or indeed more than enough, because although we're getting richer all the time, we're not actually getting any happier.
That's very revealing.
Here's a graph. So this, this shows GDP from 1973, and as you can see, it's sort of gone up and up and up and up. Well, it's dipping a bit now. But happiness has remained pretty much flat. And if you look at figures from other countries, other developed countries, they all show a similar pattern. So, you know, the conclusion they draw, it seems pretty obvious. Okay, we should switch our attention now from GDP to GDH, gross domestic happiness.
King of Bhutan is very keen on that, isn't he?
Yeah, and in fact, now a lot of countries have happiness indexes. It's certainly suggestive of something. The trouble is, we're a bit skeptical of the attempt to measure happiness. How are these happiness figures calculated? They were calculated like this. Some psychologists went around with a questionnaire and they asked people, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy would you say you are? Now, I don't know how you'd answer that question. I have no idea how to answer it. 7 out of 10? 6 out of 10? What do these figures mean? There were big problems with the methodology here, which we go into in the book. I think, and there's an even more fundamental problem with this whole enterprise of trying to maximize happiness. And that is this. Is happiness really something we want to be maximizing? Surely it all depends what you're happy about. Think of, just to take an example, this is actually a real-life example. I was friends with someone as a student, and he was heading for a failure. He was going to fail all his exams. That was obvious. But he was on a very strong dose of Prozac. So he seemed happily oblivious to this fact. when I asked him, he said, it's all going fine, no problem at all. So he was happy. Surely it would have been better for him not to be happy in that situation. He had no reason to be happy. So we think that, happiness is... You know, happiness shouldn't be the goal. The goal should be to be happy and to have good reason to be happy. So when do you have good reason to be happy? It's when your life is going well. When you have the good things of life.
I think we rapidly came to the conclusion that as an end, happiness was vacuous. It had to have, there had to be some concrete things to be happy about, just as there were to be sad about. But if happiness isn't the goal, what is?
Well, we go back to this old Greek notion of eudaimonia, as it was called. And this is often translated happiness, but it's not really. It really means something more like the good life, living well, flourishing, it's often translated. And the point is, we think this is something you can actually give some objective content to. So it's not just a matter of what you want. If you ask an economist what the good life is, they'd say, well, it depends what your tastes are. You know, for some people, the good life is living in a little country cottage in Wales and growing your own vegetables. For others, it's...
And not just an economist. It's okay. True of liberals in general, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the standard liberal view. You know, for others, it's owning a yacht in the Mediterranean. And, but we think this
Lord,
is...
Lord Mandelson's view, I think.
You can actually say a little bit more about the good life than this. You can actually be a bit sort of, prescriptive. One needn't shy away from, being prescriptive here. So, there are some lifestyles that clearly are not good, even if they're what people want. I don't know if you saw that film Shame that came out recently, a very good film. about someone whose sex life just consists of random casual encounters with prostitutes and so forth. Now, he's all these are consensual encounters, so he's not violating the law, he's not coercing anyone. His utility is maximized. I mean, this is presumably how he wants to be living. But I think we can say it's an empty life. There's something unsatisfactory about it. So we think you can actually say something objective about the good life. And in chapter 6 of our book, we try to spell out what the good life involves. And we come up with 7 what we call basic goods. Health, respect, security, personality, harmony with nature, friendship and leisure. And we think these 7 goods together make up a good life. So if you enjoy these 7 basic goods, you have a good life. If you lack one or more of them, you are injured or harmed in some way, even if you're not aware of the fact. So this gives us our measure of sufficiency. And once you have enough to enjoy these 7 basic goods, then you have enough. And to continue to strive for more at that point is just crazy. It's irrational.
And it's not an exact measure. You can't sort of top them up and say, you need £60,000 a year or £500,000 a year to enjoy these things. It's not an exact measure, but it gives you a measure. Now, could you say a bit more about some of those?
One of the most important of these basic goods, and one that's often misunderstood, is leisure. This is our last category. And often when we say we're advocates for greater leisure, people think, oh, you want people to just slack off and watch TV all day. And surely work is the one thing that keeps us sort of active and energetic and aspiring. Okay, this is not what we mean by leisure. So we distinguish leisure from mere recreation or rest. Leisure, as we use the term, means doing things for their own sake rather than as a means to an end. So leisure could be highly strenuous. I mean, leisure could be writing a book, learning to play a musical instrument, painting, all these things fall under the category of leisure.
Writing a book, by the way, is very much to the point, because when we wrote our book, it was strenuous, but we weren't doing it for some other reason. We were doing it because we wanted to. It was something we chose to do, and it was, of course, in surroundings that were beautiful, tranquil, affectionate. So there were lots of other nice things that went into it. So it was a fragment of a good life, but it was leisure, as we call it.
Even though we hopefully we'll earn some money for it, but that wasn't the primary motivation. So we come up with this definition of the good life, but then we say, how do we achieve this? Well, I suppose the problem has 2 aspects. It's partly a matter of individuals deciding for themselves that they want to lead a good life rather than just accumulating endlessly. But we also think that government has a role in making it easier for people to make that choice, in setting up the incentives so that it becomes easier to lead a good life rather than a bad life. And in the final chapter, we have a bit to say about that.
I mean, before we leave the basic goods completely, I mean, one of them, which comes first, really, in our list, is health. And we don't think of health simply in terms of extending the years of life, longevity, because that's become a proxy for welfare measures. And it's very important, obviously. I mean, people were worn out earlier on and died much sooner. So in a way, they didn't enjoy their full lifespan. But on the other hand, we're a bit suspicious, aren't we, of this idea that the idea which modern science has made possible, that we can keep people going almost indefinitely just by equipping them with spare parts and sort of other ways, until 100, 150, 200, immortality, irrespective of the quality of their life.
We think lifespan is not a good proxy for health, because you can live a very long life, but it can still be a pretty unhealthy life. Yeah. And that's not necessarily a good trade-off, in our view. So.
Well, I mean, what can government do? Well, first of all, I think there are two things that government has to pay attention to. One is to deal with the problem that we discussed originally, that a lot of people aren't in fact in a position, even in rich societies, to lead a good life. They just don't have enough. They're in poverty. And that has to be addressed. That's, of course, going beyond the rich countries of the world. That's true of 1 billion or 2 billion people in the developing countries. So for them, growth of GDP in this classic sense is still a very important objective. In rich countries, it's not so much a matter of growth as a matter of redistribution. You have to actually have to have a policy of redistribution, which we've abandoned. Basically, we've abandoned. And instead of redistribution, we offer people debt. And of course, that is a very, very insecure way of getting enough. As the recent crisis has shown, and security is one of our elements of the good life. So redistribution is one thing. The other thing, thing we have to do is to reduce the pressure to consume, because that relentless pressure to consume is one of the things that drives our growth treadmill. So there are various things we suggest which we can help on that. On the question of work and trying to reduce the hours of work, we're taking redistribution as a given factor that is part of all this. You can have much more work sharing. At the moment, we tend to divide our society into people who have worked too hard, often against their will, and people who are sort of unemployed, don't work at all. About 15-20% of the Brits really don't get nearly as much work as they want. Either they're completely unemployed, or they only have part-time or intermittent work, or they withdraw from the labour market altogether. So work sharing is one element in a solution to this. Another would be an unconditional citizen's income, which is a proposal that's long been around. There have always been objections to it. It would reduce the incentive to work. People have said, well, of course, that's one of its merits in our view of things. But an unconditional basic income, giving people a choice of their trade-off between work and leisure. So those are two elements in policies on the work side. On the reduction of consumption side, I think one thing we clearly need to do is to limit the extent of advertising without being coercive. Now, I think you want to say something about advertising.
Yeah, I mean, advertising is obviously one of the main drivers of consumption in our society. Economists, oddly enough, deny this. They say the role of advertising is purely informational. Okay, it just gives us information about products to enable us to better satisfy our wants. So, you know, we come to the market with a set of wants. We look at the adverts to work out what will best satisfy them. Now, I think, you know, this is clearly rubbish. And just to give you a couple of illustrations, I'll wrap up. You probably remember this famous Silk Cut advertising campaign. Now, what information does that convey? None whatsoever. It doesn't tell you anything. In fact, it doesn't even mention Silk Cut on the advertisement. What it does is it conveys the fact that Silk Cut is, rather sexy, glamorous, slightly, maybe slightly a sort of kinky way. I mean, this sort of sliced silk. Here's another example. This famous iPod advertising campaign of a few years back. Again, it doesn't give you any information beyond the fact that you can listen to music on your iPod. What it does is it...
Glamorous people have iPods.
Yeah, it tells you that cool people have iPods, and if you don't have one, you're not, joining the party. Okay, so advertising clearly manipulates wants. And if we want to restrain insatiability, I think one of the key ways to do that is to put some restrictions on advertising.
Yeah, and the restrictions, we already have restrictions on advertising. It's not a new principle. We already have restrictions. Certain goods are banned because we think they're harmful. In various countries, they have different ways of arranging television advertising. For example, in Scandinavia, they tend to bunch adv- advertisements at the beginning and end of programs, so you don't, in order to watch the program, you don't have to watch the ads. And that's so sensible, I think. They also ban advertising targeted specifically at children. And so on. One of our proposals is that we don't allow people to firms to write off advertising for tax reasons. They would have to pay taxes on their advertisements, on those particular business costs. In the whole framework, we propose a progressive consumption tax, which would replace income tax, and that would kill two birds with one stone, or rather three birds with one stone. First of all, it would be progressive, and therefore it would finance, say, other desirable goods in the way progressive income tax would. Secondly, it would reduce the pressure to consume. You'd be taxed on your consumption, not on your income. And third, it would encourage saving, which one needs to do to finance lengthening periods of retirement. So these are the ways we would want to go. Now, whatever you think of the proposals, and I think there are others, and these are not really advanced in a dogmatic spirit, unless you start thinking about these things, where are we going? Do we just go on and on and on? Does capitalism go on and on and on, accumulating and accumulating? To what end? And then to what end is this? Unless one starts thinking about things, I think we're on a hiding to nothing. And so it's really as an invitation to think about what the meaning of life is, what the purpose of making money is, that we've written the book.
Well, thank you both very much. We're going to try to get through as many questions as we can in the next 25 minutes. I'm going to kick off with a couple of questions for you both, but I'll be brief in my questions. If you're brief in your replies, we'll get out to the audience. First of all, Robert, there was a dichotomy in what you said between a choice between the notion of satisfaction in goods and the notion of this endless kind of quality, you know, buy more and more, having more and more beds, more and more cats, whatever it might be. But isn't the intervening variable quality in the sense that, let's just take an example, chicken curry. So if I go to Tesco, there's probably four different levels of chicken curry in Tesco, and then I could maybe buy ingredients myself and do it. I could buy fantastic ingredients and do it myself. What is the point at which the chicken curry is good enough for me to say, that's it, I've had enough quality in my chicken curry and I can stop pursuing further quality? I mean, I made this point because, as you yourselves recognise, because you got the laughter, you're slightly undermined by having written this book in the south of France rather than a travelodge in Doncaster. So this kind of sense that we pursue... Why is the pursuit of quality not endless?
Well, I think the pursuit of quality is probably endless, but it doesn't require the obsession with growth of GDP. First of all, there's quality in many things, not just in chicken curry. Although I agree, chicken curry is important, and a better quality of chicken curry is no doubt part of a good life. But there are many, 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 many improvements in quality which don't pass into GDP at all, which we could. The improvements in the quality of the environment. Lessening pollution is an improvement in quality of air, improvement in the quality of community life. So there's a lot in there, a lot of other quality improvements that aren't captured simply by growth of GDP figures. And secondly, I think many of the claims of advertisers for improvements in quality are actually quite spurious. There may be very, very, very small incremental claims. How you incremental improvements, how you offset those against the time needed to learn new tricks. For example, here am I, slave to my iPod. I've spent hours and hours and hours on these incremental improvements. And perhaps, you know, maybe they will in the end. There may be a payoff.
And of course, there's an incentive for manufacturers to build defects into things like iPads so that, you know, a year later you have to buy the new one.
Can I ask you, Edward, about this, the idea that we can reach this kind of eudaimonic state? So a lot of psychologists, particularly in the field of kind of happiness studies, would argue that what they call your set point is an important thing. So the kind of what you're born with. And maybe it's simply that great philosopher kings like you and Aristotle, that you are able to reach this level of eudaimonic consciousness. But for the rest of us, we're kind of born miserable. We're deeply aware of the hubristic nature, the pathos of human existence, the inevitability of death. And that therefore the ceaseless pursuit of ambition and money is just a way of distracting us from the fact that otherwise life's pretty miserable.
Yeah, I mean...
And there's a strong philosophical tradition that would argue that, of course, you know.
Yeah. Of course, I mean, for Aristotle, eudaimonia is an ideal. I mean, he thinks not many people can reach it.
So why are you encouraging all of us to pursue it, then?
I mean, there are all kinds of impediments. But, I mean, what we're saying is that we should try and sort of arrange our social lives so that people at least have a chance of attaining eudaimonia, so that, the material barriers to achieving it are removed. I mean, what they then do with that opportunity depends, yes, largely on quirks of individual psychology. I mean, if you had a really unhappy childhood, that may, be a barrier to achieving eudaimonia. And obviously the state can't do anything about that. But it can remove some of these material impediments. That's all we're saying.
But
consumerism is more egalitarian than eudaimonia, it seems to me. We can all buy a bigger... Well, we can all pursue the aim of buying a faster car, but only a few of us are able to reach this enlightened consciousness.
Yeah, but only a few of us are able to afford a faster car. I mean, or rather, the kind of car that the very rich people can costs £150,000 or £200,000, or the £5 million house. But, you know, these are the goals that our society set us. I think in order to pursue eudaimonia, you also have to have an idea of what the good life is. In other words, there's a philosophy of the good life. We have a philosophy of growth and consumerism, and then everything else is you pick and choose between the different objects of consumption that are offered to you. Whereas we're to say, look, if you actually come to understand what a good life is and what it can offer, then I think your choices will be different. They will be informed by your idea of what a good life is.
So let me turn to you again as an economist. And ask about the realism, because I absolutely take your point that longer life is not in and of itself a good, regardless of quality, but we are living longer. And I'm sure you read the recent Office of Budgetary Responsibility report on medium-term public spending profiles. That argues that I think by 2030, over half of public spending will be going on pensions, healthcare, or social care. So it looks as though even to maintain a decent quality of life for our aging population requires economic growth, because without economic growth, we simply aren't going to meet that need.
Well, I think there are two quick answers to that. First of all, you can distribute the work-leisure trade-off much more evenly among the population than we now do. Some people, younger people, could work less. Older people could work more. It's not that you must work more, and your retirement is an illusion, a mirage. Now you get back to work to someone age 90. I mean, that's of course not the idea, but there's no reason why we should have these sharp cut-off points, which we've been used to, and which are really based on the idea that people died soon after they gave up work. Secondly, this is where progressive consumption tax can play its part, by increasing saving out of your earnings. And saving would be exempt from tax under a progressive consumption tax. And so people would be encouraged to save for their retirement. I don't think all retirement will be financed in the future, nearly to the same extent as it is now, by public savings. I think people will have to put aside money for that. But that is a very legitimate object of saving, and that's something that should be encouraged.
And finally for me, Edward, before we open it up, what did you disagree about? It's not in the book. In the book it implies that the two of you agreed about absolutely everything, which I think also slightly lacks credibility. So give us an insight into something that about which you really do disagree or that didn't go in the book because you couldn't agree about it.
Well, I mean, there weren't any really fundamental disagreements of substance. There were some differences of emphasis or tone, maybe. I think Robert managed to restrain my moralizing tendencies, and quite rightly.
And what did you restrain in him?
I think we have rather different approaches to writing things down on the page. Edward, I think, would admit to this. I mean, he likes to have things, work out things in his head pretty clearly, and then when he writes them down, they are not, he doesn't think they need very much revision because he's thought it all. He's thought it all out. I mean, whereas I tend to write down ideas much more roughly, and then it's sort of an invitation to tear them to pieces, criticize them, and everything else. So I think that was a sort of, that emerged as a difference in writing style, not as a difference in opinion.
No wonder that final stage of the book took a little bit longer than you thought it was going to. Okay, so let me take two or three questions at a time, if that's all right.
Thanks. I just wanted to go back a tiny bit. You come up with these seven, is it seven, goods, yes. Which sounded really perfect, lovely, delightful. I just wasn't quite sure how you leapt from a sort of slight condemnation of the simplistic kind of, you know, how satisfied are you with your life, happiness notion, to come to your seven, or was it just brainstorming in a very nice environment that... Because they kind of feel like very reasonable ideas. I just wondered if you could give us a sentence on that.
I mean, you don't have kind of Schadenfreude or lust or...
I mean, it's true. I mean,
I quite like the sound of all of them, but I just wondered how you got to them.
An air of arbitrariness does hang over all
which is okay. I'm very happy with that thought.
But we try to avoid that by sort of giving ourselves some you know, criteria of basicness. So basic goods had to be final, okay? In other words, they had to be ends in themselves rather than means to other things. So that rules out money, which is obviously a means to an end. They had to be universal, so... They had to be things that people from cultures around the world agreed on, more or less. They had to be sui generis, which meant that they had to be not part of some other, you know, good. And finally, they had to be indispensable. So they had to be things without which you'd be seriously harmed or damaged in some way. So, you know, missing a sort of set-completing stamp would not count as a basic good. Because they're incommensurable, you see. So that means you can't sort of trade them off against each other like you might trade off currencies against each other. I mean, if you lack one of these basic goods, to that extent, your life is worse. And even if you have a lot of another one, it doesn't compensate.
Yeah, you arrange your proportions yourself. But, I mean, you know, you obviously attach more weight to something, one thing rather than another.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to a lot of the policy suggestions, I'm sure people will be, but I'm also struck that, in a sense, they're not all that new. I mean, people have been talking about critiques of GDP and focus on growth since, you know, Kuznets and railing against advertising since, you know, at least the 60s and so on. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about how these kind of policies will get enacted. I mean, we often find, I mean, redistribution is an example where polls consistently say that people would like more redistribution but then don't vote for it or don't appear to want it when it's offered to them politically. How do we, you know, galvanize democratic movement towards these kind of policies?
Well, could I just... You make the case and then try to get some political support for it. Just to take redistribution, until the 1980s, it was generally accepted in the West that there should be a strong redistributionary element in the tax system. There was a progressive income tax. There's still a progressive income tax, but it's been watered down and replaced by the philosophy that any marginal tax rate above 40% or 45% would sort of kill the economy. Now, that was an ideological position. There was a lot of support for it at the time, and so that became the orthodoxy. But things can change, and you have to make... the left really lost the argument sometime in the 1960s and 1970s, 1970s in particular, in this country, in the United States, not so much in Europe, by the way. But it's got to regain. And what I call left, I don't think these are party political points, but what, you know, that, you know what I mean by that. So you've got to be able to recover, reclaim the lost ground.
Thank you. That was fascinating. I'll try and keep it simple. I would love to know, in your hours of work, if you'd done a study between 1950 and today in the hours of housework and childcare.
So what about housework and childcare? We spend more time with our children than we used to in the 50s, I know that, but yeah.
Mine's a fairly simple question. Is, given that the world is very variable, is there anywhere you think comes closest to the kind of view you advocate?
Ah, yes. If we want to buy a house in Eudaimonia, where should we move to?
quick question about what you mentioned about tax on consumption and savings. Even if you have higher savings, do those savings not need to be invested and therefore those companies need consumption in some form to grow? So does it really step away from the need for a consumption-led society?
Okay, so we have three interesting questions there. One is, one is a question about what about kind of domestic and parental labour, what's happened to that? Do we do more of that? Secondly, a question about where comes closest to your paradise on earth? And then thirdly, what would people save in? You know, they have to save in something, and in order to save in something, they have to save in companies, and those companies have to flog things in order to make money on your savings.
In answer to the first question, oddly enough, hours of housework have increased since the 1960s, which is a strange result given the, you know, the vast increase in domestic appliances. I think that's mainly time spent with children, which has increased.
And shopping.
And shopping as well, yeah. I mean, whether to count this as part of work or leisure is, I don't know. I mean, it's a tricky issue. Obviously, a lot of housework is work.
Yeah, I think also conveying people and goods from place to place has taken up more and more of a day. So, surprising results. Where is eudaimonia to be found? Well, you know, different countries have different bits of what one would call the good life. For example, the Dutch, if you were living in Holland, you'd be working much less, about 5 to 10 hours a week less than we do in Britain, without any loss of income. Per capita income in Holland, in the Netherlands, is actually higher than in this country. That would be one element. I mean, there'd be elements of that in Scandinavia. I mean, there'd be elements, you can find the elements scattered all over the place. Even in bits of America, there'd be elements of the good life, certainly. And as for, the investment of saving, well, what you need is not to lose your money in saving. I mean, if you save, certain that you don't have to maximize your return on your saving. I mean, most people are very, very happy if they get a small return on their saving, but it doesn't disappear. That, you know, they get what they expect. Isaac Newton used to put aside a little amount of gold every year for his old age, and he accumulated a pot of gold. And then when he retired, he never really properly retired, but nevertheless, that was intended for his old age. It didn't. This is the point about gold, is it didn't lose its value. So I don't think, you know, I don't think we have to relentlessly want to maximize our returns. At the moment, the pension funds are actually losing money by investing it in gilts, because the rate of return they're getting is lower than the current rate of inflation. So they're losing money, and all the people who put, you know, rely on them for their pensions are insecure as a result.
I should just add, we're not saying that the goal of government should be to eliminate growth. We're just saying that it shouldn't be to maximise growth. So it should be to secure the basic goods for all citizens and then let growth fall out as it will. You know, perhaps we'll carry on growing a bit, perhaps we won't. That doesn't really matter. We're not dogmatic anti-growth.
No. And growth of what? Growth of what is very, very important. That's the question you always have to ask. Growth of what? Not necessarily growth of GDP.
Brilliant. Well, this is the point at which I normally say, I've read the book, and it's absolutely brilliant, and that you should get it too, on behalf of the authors. But, of course, as we're opposed to advertising, and the authors wrote the book for entirely intrinsic reasons, I'm going to say to you, I enjoyed the book. I've no idea whether you will. It's completely up to you. And it is a matter of utter indifference to the authors whether or not you buy it, because they've already got their satisfaction, intrinsic satisfaction, from their struggle in the south of France for 2 months. But if nevertheless you're interested in the book, which is actually a very, very beautiful little book, and is wonderful to read, I very much enjoyed reading it, then it's available outside. And today, of course, you get two author's signatures for the price of one. So it just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Edward and Robert Skidelsky.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.